So we start these the same way because you're going to be brilliant and I'm going to be boring. So would you introduce yourself, please?
Okay, my name is Gary Newman.
So one of the things that was really interesting that I was reading that I didn't realize is that, and I think it's brilliant because my parents were the same with me in a creative career, that your parents really supported you and they didn't have a lot of money, but they invested in music equipment very early on, right?
Yeah, when they bought me a guitar when I was very young. They bought me an acoustic one. They bought me an electric guitar a bit later. I was the only kid in my school to have a Gibson Les Paul when I was about 16, which is quite a big thing to get. And it wasn't as if they were rich, nothing like that at all. The only reason we got a record deal at all with Beggar's Banquet was because we already had our own van, thanks to my dad. We'd already recorded the single, thanks to my mum and dad. And we had a little PA system that we could actually do small clubs and pubs with, which we carried ourselves, again thanks to my parents. I didn't realize it at the time, but my parents actually sank pretty much all of their life savings into that equipment. I never told me that it was that important. I didn't find out until many years later. So yeah, I owe them everything, really.
And your dad was a British Airways bus driver, correct?
He did a bit of everything with British Airways, actually. On that side of it, he did crew coaches, baggage handling, that kind of thing, you know.
Wow. Back then, that was a very different gig, wasn't it? It wasn't as modern as it is today by any stretch.
But before pallets and such like. Yeah. When you crawl around underneath an airplane bent double.
Yeah. So I figured this out because we're talking 1979. You're a year younger than me. And you mentioned how you got to Beggars, which I didn't know. That's not really been written up in any way, shape, or form. And then we got it over here on ATCO, and you know, next thing you know, it's big label. But having a hit that fast and that early out of the gate, that must have been scary in some ways.
It is, actually, yeah. I think people looking in from the outside just see what looks to be a dream come true, which in a way is exactly what it is. But when it happens very, very quickly, every single part of your life changes overnight. Everything. You can't walk down the street. You can't go to the places you've been going to. Your friends are different. Everyone you meet sort of knows who you are. Some people want to use that. Some people love you. Some people violently don't. And you kind of have to grasp as much of this as you can and go with it. And you're learning all the time, every day you're learning how to handle these things which are new and shocking every day. And I think a sudden rise is a very difficult thing to deal with. You know, I've said 1,001 times that any kind of success that comes, if it comes in gradual stages, is by far the best way to do it. You learn how to be. You learn what the workload is, what the pressure is. You learn how to handle people and their expectations of you, and sometimes the weirdnesses that come with that. A gradual rise is by far the best way. Because, you know, by the time you get to a high level, you're experienced in all aspects of it, the press, the whatever it might be, you're experienced in every aspect of it. And it's got to be the best way to do it. I didn't do it that way. It's not as if you can choose, though, really. No, nobody chooses the way that happens to them. It does or it doesn't. And for me, it really was overnight. On a Monday morning, I had no one had ever heard of me. The next day, I did Top of the Pops, and everyone knew who I was. Similar thing happened in America. When I came to America, I remember getting off the airplane and walking through the terminal in New York. No one knew who I was. That night, did Saturday Night Live. The next day I woke up and everyone knew who I was. Everyone.
And there was no social media back in your day, but there was Saturday Night Live, which started in 1975 or so. So it was at the peak of people watching it.
Yeah, I think they told me at the time that the audience for the program at the time I was doing it was around 50 million people. And it went out live as well. So, and we did that at Merv Griffin, actually, I think, in the same weekend. So.
Merv Griffin was great.
Yeah, I love Merv Griffin.
People forget how influential, you know, some of these people really were, whether it's a Jules Holland today, but, you know, it's so different. If you go on a show today, it's a whole different game in terms of being a musician and going on a television show.
I think there's so many different ways these days to go about what you do. Everything has become fragmented. Now, there was a time when, in Britain, for example, there was only Top of the Pops, actually. That was it. That was your music program. If you got on Top of the Pops, you were famous because everybody watched it. You know, I think something like a quarter of the population watched it every Thursday night. Phenomenally powerful and important.
And you were, and the thing about Top of the Pops is it was an equalizer because it was Cliff Richards, and it would be you. And then there would be, you know, another very, Sweet, and then people, you know, and it's very different because if you were there, you were there. And it was just egalitarian. If you were making it the charts, you were on.
Well,
there were
yeah.
No formats back then.
The thing that I notice now, as music has become much more fragmented, and yeah, there are specialist TV channels for all different kinds of music, specialist radio channels now. So if you like a certain kind of music, you go to that TV channel or that music channel, whatever it is, and so you only ever hear that particular type of music. And in a way, it's encouraged people to stop experimenting with what they listen to, and it's made it more difficult to cross boundaries. The thing that was good about programs like Top of the Pops, or these general music programs, is that I might see something on there that I probably wouldn't normally have gone for, and yet thought, actually, that's really quite good. You know, and I would never, electronic music probably wouldn't have happened without Top of the Pops, because it wouldn't have been given a chance anywhere. Nobody was vibing to it at all, you know. So it was just one of those things. It enabled you to cross musical boundaries, and I think that's more difficult now because everything has become compartmentalized into a ridiculous degree. And there's good things that come with that. It's not all bad, you know, the opportunities that are there now to be independent, for example, to not go the major label route and so on. These are all good things that have come along and given bands more opportunities to control their own destinies and their own music, which were not there before. You know, you can reach out with social media now in a way. Doesn't mean it's easy, but it's possible in a way that wasn't possible at all before. If you didn't have a major label on you, and or you were extremely lucky, no one was ever going to hear about you. You needed them to come up with advertising and marketing budgets and this sort of thing, to put ads in papers, because that was the only way people were going to hear about you.
And you had one of the earliest syncs for Lee Cooper Jeans, right?
Well, actually, that was just me doing a guest vocal on something.
Was that really?
Yeah, I didn't actually write it. There was an advertising agency who got the job to do the music for the Lee Cooper Jeans ad, and he had an office next door to the man that published my stuff, and he heard my first album was being played in the office, and he came in and said, "Who's that?" That's the voice they got me to do it, because that was the voice he wanted.
Very Brill Building, isn't it?
Yeah, I got £40 for that, and then they changed the lyrics for some reason. Nothing to do with me. I didn't write any of it. I just sang it. And so I got £40 again, because I had to go back and sing it again. So, and at that time, I was earning £12 a week on benefit. So
that was a lot of money.
Yeah, I thought I'd made it then.
I'll take
yeah.
that.
And then 6 months later, I think, or less, I was number one and everything changed.
But comebacks. I was watching this morning, 1981. 1981, think how many years we're talking about. You did a farewell concert. So was that the moment where, I mean, when you do a farewell concert, was that you saying, okay, I've done what I've done. I've done it for a short period of time. I get it now, and I want to move on to something new? Because obviously it was the non-farewell concert, because we're sitting here today.
No, at the time it was a very genuine desire to want to back out of the whole thing. And a live work I'm talking about. I mean, I had a very, my relationship with the media when I first started, in Britain especially, was really poor.
Well, I was going to say, and we'll get right to it. I was a subscriber to Melody Maker back in the day, but I went back and looked at the NME, which you can do. And you know, even today, the NME either loves you or they can put you on the front page and destroy you. And was that kind of part of it in some ways?
In a way, what happened to me was, it as we were saying before, it was all very sudden, and I'd had this overnight rise from nothing to massive in most parts of the world, and I just didn't take to it, to be honest. It wasn't what I expected, and I was shocked by it, and I wanted to calm everything down. It felt to me as if I suddenly lost control of my entire life, certainly my career, and it wasn't what I wanted. And I wanted to slow everything down. I wanted to take a breath, try to understand and grasp what had happened, and then kind of mature a little bit. I was still a kid when all this was going on, and I wanted to mature a little bit, and I wanted to concentrate on my songwriting. And I thought live work was getting in the way. I did two world tours in 1 year, you know, the first year, which is, you know, pretty heavy going. And I wanted to concentrate on songwriting. Even though I'd had number one singles and albums, I still thought my songwriting needed to be much better. And so I think it was actually one of the few really sensible things I ever decided to do. But what I did wrong was make a big fuss about it. I should never have said I was going to do it. I should have just quietly done it, taken a step back, taken that breath, and then moved back in when I felt I was a bit more ready for it. I didn't feel I was ready for it, but I wasn't. I was naive, I guess, and so I'm going to tell everyone I'm going to retire, you know, so I make a big song and dance about it. I never said I was retiring from music. I just said from the live work, but it got misreported so many times you get sick to death of explaining it, so eventually you just go, you know, whatever, you know. Did it, dropped out for a couple of years, I think it was, not sure exactly. Did the farewell shows just to say thank you to everybody, fans and so on. And then did it, went back, made an album, didn't tour it, made another album, and then came back with that one, I think, about 2 years after I said I was going to stop. And eased back into touring again in America, actually. I came back here and started touring again here. So it was actually... I think probably that one of the most important decisions I ever made. I think if I hadn't have done that, and if I'd have carried on going the way I was going, I'd have just...
You wouldn't have been doing it today.
No, I don't think I would have been, no.
But I've been waiting for this for about a year to say this, because it's interesting, because I had the Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark folks in discussion, and they turned and they said, you know, we were, and it's a very similar story, we were perking along, and they said, and then Gary Newman came along. Being that you're held responsible for so many things, the original, and when I say held responsible in a good way, but the idea of, you know, starting with sampling very early on, the idea of how you used a guitar and then manipulated it, the, you know, all of these things that people, you know, hold you responsible for, and then all the way down the road, straight down to, you know, Trent these days and Nine Inch Nails and all of that. When you're going along on all this, and then people like me turn to you and say, well, you know, you, if it weren't for you, there wouldn't be this, 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 and this. When you're going along and you're doing this, do you have any sense of this whatsoever?
To be honest, no. Yeah, man, I don't think anyone that, well, I would be surprised if anyone that's ever done anything that is in time considered to be innovative thinks they're doing anything innovative when they're actually doing it. When I stumbled across synthesizers, I went to a studio to make a punk rock guitar album, and there it was in the corner, and I had a go and loved it and adapted the music there and then. So I went back to the record company with an electronic album instead of a punk album, which was they weren't happy about. I felt that I was lucky, you know, it just, if it hadn't have been there, I would never have made that electronic album. Then somebody else would have come along and done it before me, and I would have been forever trying to catch up. I love electronic music, I never loved it until I found my way of doing it. I mean, I liked Kraftwerk, didn't love it. I liked what Eno was doing with Bowie on the low thing, but didn't want to do it. I wasn't interested in doing that sort of thing. So it had never captured me to the point where I thought, actually, this is going to be what I do with my life, this will be my career, until I found it in that studio. And then it was because I was adapting guitar based songs into electronic songs on the fly, you know, there and then in the heat of the moment. So I come across using electronic music and combining it with guitar based drums and conventional instrumentation, and I ended up with this new form of music, I guess, which was familiar enough to be comfortable and different enough to be exciting. And that's why it crossed the bridge, I think.
But this is just my opinion, but what I think is different is, and that people don't understand, that you really did start with guitar and keyboard, you know, that you didn't just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to make, and for me, when I really go back and I listen to it, or I even listen to, we're going to talk about Splinter in a couple of minutes, it's still all about hooks. You know, every riff, everything that you do has a melodic thing that starts it out, and then that's the thing that you build upon to make the song. So it's really, and again, we don't talk about influences in these interviews ever, But when you really come right down to it, it's classic old school rock and roll songwriting that then you discovered more interesting ways and new ways to overlay it with different instrumentation, right?
My first number one album was called Replicas in Britain, and half of that doesn't even have keyboards on it. You know, half the songs in there. So I was still cautiously finding my way with it, right up until the third album. My third album was called Pleasure Principle, which is the one that had Cars on it. That was full on. I mean, every song on it had an electronic part to it, but still had guitar, bass and drums. No, not guitar. Still had bass and drums, actually, on that one. I took guitar off it as an experiment. But songwriting should be the foundation of any kind of music, of any genre of music. You know, if you don't have songs underneath it, whatever amount of trickery you pour onto something in a studio, if you can't strip all that away and still have a song that you could just sit there and sing, and it would have meaning still, or an emotional point to it to some people, then you're not a songwriter. And I think more than anything, I'm a songwriter first, and then a fairly average musician very much second.
I don't know if everybody would agree with that. But Splinter, I kid you not, as I was taking my daughter for pizza this afternoon, I'm busy whistling this song, and she says, "What's the song, Dad?" And I'm going, and I'm not going to whistle it for you because I'm not a good whistler. So here's Splinter. And here we are in the 2000s, and when you come right down to it, you're still making songs that are whistleable. But this new record, it's not that it's a return to form, because you've never left form, right? And people have written it up that way, and I really kind of want to clear that up, because I don't think it's you know what I mean? Every time you read something about you, it's, well, he's got a return to form. How many return to forms can you possibly have when you're doing what you've done all along?
Yeah, it's the same thing. People talk about comebacks and
return to form. You've come back. How many times have you come back, Gary?
I've lost count how many times I've come back.
But if you ever left, is the bigger question.
Not really. This is the. I think
it's a lot of comebacks.
A lot of comebacks. Yeah, a lot of comebacks. This is all I've done since I've been an adult. I've only ever made albums for my whole life. Some of them people didn't hear about them because they didn't do very well. A few years later, you do another one. People hear about it and say, "Oh, you're making a comeback." Actually, no. There's two others you didn't know about that, you know, that didn't do so well. It's been a very, very up and down career.
But how many people don't say that? I mean, again, people are always looking for the story. That's not the story. That's if you're an artist or a musician.
It's difficult. You know, the first bit of success came along, and suddenly, you know, there's lots of money and people know who you are, and it all feels pretty cool and life is good. And then it starts to, but you've done that with full integrity. You just wrote songs that you loved and you were lucky and you made it and it's great. And, you know, and then a few years go by and things not going so well. And the money's vanishing, and you know they're trying to repossess my house at one point, and it's, you know, really grim, and it's not so cool anymore, and things are not going very well, and then you panic, you kind of panic in slow motion in a way, and for the first time ever you start to listen to advice, and that's a kiss of death, because everyone knows what you should be doing. Everyone that can't do it themselves knows what you should be doing, and you must never listen to these people, but you do, because your own judgment is no longer working, it's not succeeding anymore. And so you start to write songs based on what the latest bit of opinion is, and you know what's in the chart, and to get on the radio, and that is when you sell out, in my opinion. You don't sell out when you sell lots of records if you made them with a good heart and it's what you loved. You sell out when you start writing music to try to get on radio, or to try to keep an A&R man happy, or to salvage a career that is failing. That's when you sell out, and that's what I did. And I'm very ashamed of that. And it wasn't until 93, 94 when I met Gemma. I met Jeremy in 92. And I learned my lesson. I did a really bad album in 92 called Machine and Soul. Learned my lesson from that. Changed my attitude completely. Pretty much gave up, actually, is what happened. I thought I was finished. Went back to making songs for the love of it again, as a hobby. Stopped thinking about career and commercial success and all that kind of thing. Gemma was really lovely and gave me lots of my confidence back, because my confidence was gone, shot to bits. She introduced me to music I hadn't heard before, all kinds of interesting stuff, including Trent. And I just went back to music with the attitude that I had when I was a kid. I loved it again, and I just wanted to make music that I was proud of. And luckily, there were still enough people around, I guess, to bite on that. And we bottomed out and things started to do a little bit better. I self-released that album, that's called Sacrifice, but it was much heavier, much darker, much more kind of industrial sounding. And the thing that was important to me was it was refinding that attitude that I had and that love of making music just for the love of making the music. And you're not thinking about charts and A&R men, all these things. It doesn't come into your head anymore. And it was fantastic. And it was like rediscovering your childhood. It was such a brilliant experience. And I've never lost it. Never lost it. And I'm doing it for the same reasons today. And I think that's one of the reasons why Splinter is coming out so well. It's just that same attitude. And I'm learning now. I'm learning how to make this sort of music better. And I'm loving it more and more as time goes by. And I think it's just showing. You know, I had a lot of emotional things that happened in the gap between Splinter and the one before. This whole depression thing kicked in. That was a bummer. But, you know, but got through that. And that gives you an awful lot of things to write about. And Aid Fenton, who produced it, was on the best form he's ever been on.
Let's clear up two things. Let's clear up that electronic music is not nostalgia, and the whole analog versus digital, that these things just need to be out of the conversation from here on in.
I actually couldn't care less about analog, digital, or Timbuktu. I absolutely do not care what makes a noise. I only care if I like the noise. I have no interest in analog or digital debates whatsoever. I do not care. Half the sounds in the album came from me walking around with a machine very much like your dictaphone there, kicking things, banging things, scraping bits across a concrete floor, making noises that you can then manipulate, mess with, turn into music. That's half the fun of it. And as far as nostalgia is concerned, well, I understand that there are electronic music has been around long enough now that it's actually developed its own nostalgia. There are people coming into it who are able to look back at the sort of electronic music that was around 35 years ago when I started, and they look back at it with kind of like a romantic glint in their eye, as if it was some kind of major thing. But I guess
like a dinosaur in a museum,
in a way. I mean, but I half understand it as somebody coming in looking back at a golden age, what might be seen as a golden age, when something really did change in music dramatically, because it happens very, very rarely, very rarely, maybe half a dozen times in history of popular music, I would think, and electronic music was certainly one of them. So I kind of understand why people have that sort of view, and maybe even of the equipment. And you hear these glowing reports of old gear, and I just think that's not the way I remember it. Yeah, exactly. When that was all we had at all. But I'm into it, and I always have been, because it's forward looking. It's about what you create next, where you go with it, and that's the thing that excites me about it. And that's why I sometimes do struggle to understand this looking backwards, this nostalgia thing about electronic music, because for me it's the reason it's there is because it only moves forward. You know, every album we come up with new sounds, new ways of manipulating, new technologies. It's the only genre that can do that. And so I find it slightly frustrating that people are coming into it, some people, and looking backwards to be inspired. I've never thought looking backwards to be inspired was a good thing, but not a criticism. You know, people are cool with that, and people want to do that, fine, that's up to them. But it just doesn't work for me, and it never will.
What I've done is I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and what I do is I play 40 minutes of solid music. So it's two of your songs on either end, and then just off the top of your head, name six or seven songs by anybody else that you want to play, and I play it with no interruption whatsoever. It's rare on the radio, but I get away with